my personality to be jittery. It's part of my charm.
Wrestling fans,
are you ready?
It's time for my 1-2-3 cents of a podcast on the Jittery Monkey Podcasting Network.
Give me a hell yeah!
Now, here's your host.
The man is also a very long, dear, personal friend of mine.
Does the guy have a name?
Yes, he has a name.
Kevin Huntsberger.
Woo!
Everyone, welcome to episode 145 of my 1-2-3 cents, the podcast, and we're doing something different this time around. I'll be bringing Chad in just a moment, and we're going to do something. We're calling this My Sixth Sense, basically, because we are doing a top six list of favorites, favorite matches or moments from the summertime, and it can be any summer, any kind of moment or match, as long as it involves the world of professional wrestling. Before I bring Chad in, though, and explain kind of how we got this idea, I do want to remind folks officially now, I do have the Collar and Elbow store up and ready to go, so it's you can get to it the write up here on my 1-2-3 cents, or follow Collar X Elbow on social media and just use the promo code my 1-2-3 cents and you get a discount, and it works out. It's if you don't know about it, it's the basically pro wrestling t-shirts, and right now it's just t-shirts, but Al Snow is behind the project, so check it out again. Promo code my 1-2-3 cents. It's that easy. You enter it in, and you know, let me know if you head over there and sign up and take a look at it. So I'm honored to be a part of that affiliate program, and a thanks again to Farmer Billy Hills for kind of giving me that kick in the ass to get signed up for it and get it going. So speaking of Farmer, he's a big part of the Stride Pro Wrestling Show coming up September 9th. I'll have more on that on next week's episode, but now let's bring Chad into the conversation. And Chad, we're doing something from a podcast that you listened to and suggested to me. It's called, and I do listen to it too, that's where we kind of developed this idea. It's Tom and Jim's Top 5, and they take a look at their top 5 favorite things from different aspects of pop culture. And I think they're probably about a decade younger than us.
Yeah, I believe they're both in their mid-30s, which, you know, makes me a little weary of some of their top 5 picks. And also when Tom or Jim, I don't know why I can't keep them straight as to who's who. But I know Jim is not big on the 80s, it seems, so I don't know how I feel about that. But I do enjoy their show. As we record this, their latest episode just dropped, which was Top 5 Saved by the Bell episodes. And I thought it was a really good episode and had me questioning, what were my top five Saved by the Bell episodes?
Well, yeah, the I'm So Excited one definitely has to be in the conversation, and they did have that on their list, so I appreciate that. But the premise of their show, you know, we're stealing their blueprint, basically, and just adding one, because we added up the 1-2-3 and my 1-2-3 cents to come up with 6 cents. And like I said, we're going to kind of ping pong back and forth and talk about our 6 favorite matches or moments from this week, since it is SummerSlam week. And by the way, Chad, and I don't want to go into a whole big diatribe, but what were your overall thoughts and impressions of SummerSlam 2017? I'm assuming none of the matches or moments are on your top 6 list.
Well, you would be wrong.
Oh, really?
Yes. But overall, way too long of a show. I understand why WWE is making WrestleMania and SummerSlam into like 6-7 hour long epic events. But I think the show, especially for what was on the show, there just wasn't a lot of interest going into the show for me, and a lot of it didn't pay off. Rusev doing the job to Randy Orton in, you know, 15 seconds. There was something else that was really short that I can't remember. But I just, overall, I thought it was a very mediocre show.
All right.
Except, thing that makes my list. So.
Okay, well, I can't wait to hear this. So we are going to do the top six favorite moments, because obviously this is a subjective thing. We're sharing our opinions, our 1, 2, 3 cents on today's 6 cents. So, Chad, start us off. What is your number six?
Well, let's just get right to it. Number six will come from SummerSlam 2017, and I think the reason why it isn't higher is because it's too fresh, but the reason why it's at number six is because it's so fresh, it's still in my memory. And that is the four-way match between Brock Lesnar, Braun Strowman, Roman Reigns, and Samoa Joe. This was probably the only match that I really paid attention to on the show, and I think it was pretty well laid out in regards to letting everyone shine and really getting over Braun Strowman, and it makes me more interested in the Braun Strowman Brock Lesnar match coming up at No Mercy.
So, do you think Braun is going to beat Brock?
No, I'm not that silly to think that the guy that the fans want to see as champion will actually get a chance to be champion until way past the time when the fans have stopped caring about him.
Gotcha. Makes sense. And I saw bits and pieces of that match. I have not finished watching SummerSlam, but like you said, it was an epic event, epic time-wise event. But yeah, I agree from what I saw, the reviews of that match, and that was one of the highly anticipated matches. So I look forward to going back and watching that in full. My number six, and I'm most of my picks, spoiler alert, are very nostalgic. So I'm living in the past. But my number six is from June 1983, and it was Jimmy Superfly Snuka and Don Morocco, the Magnificent Morocco, who was the Intercontinental Champion at the time. They had a confrontation on Championship Wrestling, and it was a summer night. I had some friends over, was flipping through the channels, was not a wrestling fan per se at that time. I had seen some wrestling, but did not identify as a fan. I happened to stop on Championship Wrestling. That was the old WWF program at the time, and Morocco and Snuka were arguing. Morocco spat on Snuka. Snuka jumped over the top rope onto Morocco, who was standing on the floor, and just beat the hell out of him, ripped his suit off, and after that, it was over. I became an instant fan and did not stop watching after that incident. So I picked it for the nostalgia purpose, and really that's kind of what got me into the whole wrestling thing.
Yeah, I think that predated my fandom, because I believe when I started back in 84, the IC title was going between Tito Santana and Jimmy Hart, or Greg Valentine with Jimmy Hart.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and that was a summertime feud as well, so.
Well, there we go. If I can't remember one of my choices, we'll come back to that one.
All righty. You want to go with number five?
Sure. I am going with...
Hey, before you go any further, do you think we have any of the same? Because sometimes Tom and Jim have the same, and I find that interesting.
I'm going to say probably not.
I'm thinking we don't either, so.
There might be one thing.
Okay.
We'll see. But my next one I'm going with is probably one of the greatest specialty matches of all time, and one that I know fans would love to see make a comeback. And that is the War Games match held on July 4th, 1987, which featured the Road Warriors, Dusty Rhodes, Nikita Koloff, and Paul Ellery versus the Four Horsemen of Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, Lex Luger, and James J. Dillon. And I'm going with this one because I believe this was the only War Games that fits into the parameters of the summertime, although I'm probably mistaken.
Slightly, but yes, continue.
Okay. Well, what other ones are there?
Well, they did...
Because they moved War Games to Fall Brawl.
Well, they did. They did a series of War Game matches that summer. July 4th just happened to be the first one. They weren't all televised, obviously.
Right.
But for I'm going to cut you for just a second. This was actually my original number five, and I took it off. and replaced it with something else. So it's one of my honorable mentions now. But yes, the original War Games was a pretty epic event at the time.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, War Games is probably one of my favorite match types. And, you know, having Dusty versus the Horsemen, which was an epic feud. And having the managers get involved too, and having two capable managers in the ring, because I believe both J.J. Dillon and Paul Ellery, and I can't say his name, but I'm going to say Paul. I can't say Paul E, because that's a whole nother manager. Mr. .com, if you will. I believe they were both former wrestlers before transitioning into managers.
That is correct.
Yeah, so. You know, so it wasn't like having, a manager like a Slick or I'm trying to think of other managers that...
Jimmy Hart really didn't wrestle.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. No, that's a good choice. I like that one. My number five is also a WCW-related event. It's July 7th, 1996, Bash at the Beach. The NWO forms, brother. And, you know... I've talked about it before on this show and in the blog. I was always WWE, WWF first. So I felt like I had to add this event because it really did, and not to sound over dramatic, but it really did kind of change the course of wrestling for a very long time. You know, just the idea of Hogan turning bad, the mystery that kind of led to it. What's that?
Said Bullet Club still going on, still impacting wrestling today.
Yeah, true. So yeah, the influence, the sheer influence alone. Again, I wasn't a huge. I loved wrestling. I love wrestling, but you know, I was not always going to pick the. I don't think I ever ordered a WCW pay per view, for example. But I can recognize the significance and the symbol, the symbolism behind. The whole formation of the NWO and what it meant today. And I mean, people still today talk about the NWO, like Chad said, Bullet Club and others who have emulated that group. So it was something great at the beginning. And then, you know, I feel like a lot of things in wrestling, they watered it down and then it became, you know, Virgil and IRS and Scott Norton as a part of the group. So.
I think Scott Norton is still wrestling today and having decent matches.
That's true. And that wasn't a diss at Scott Norton. I wish they would have kind of kept it as that upper main event level talent and not, you know, like the Horsemen. They were an elite group. There were four guys. And yeah, I understand that down the way, you know, we had Mongo McMichael and Paul Roma in there. But, you know, there was that, the Shield, for example. You know, I don't want to see Mojo Rawley as a member of the Shield anytime soon. But I digress.
I think you do. I think you just don't know it.
Number four.
I was kind of going back and forth with which match I wanted to choose. And both of them come from my very first WWF show. I know you were there as well. We did not know each other. That would have been really odd if we found out that we were sitting next to each other like years later.
I forgot all about this.
There's a new DVD coming out, I think, called Best of Unreleased Matches or something along those lines. And it will feature a match involving Jerry Lawler and Hakushi against the very random, I believe only once or twice pairing of Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels.
Yes.
However, that is not the match I'm going with.
Oh, okay.
I am going with the main event from that night.
Oh, even better.
A steel cage match. Champion Diesel putting the belt on the line. Not against Psycho Sid, who was the original challenger but had a broken fingernail and could not wrestle.
Softball injury.
Diesel versus Yokozuna in a cage match.
Yes, that was epic.
Tried to climb the cage.
Yes, that was awesome.
That's one word for it. even in that day, that was like right, I think, at the start of my getting into the online dirt sheets and the, you know, the new, really pulling the curtain back, if you will, from wrestling. But I think even at that point, when you put Yokozuna in a cage match, something just screams, he's not winning.
Right.
There's no chance of him winning. So while I don't know how many other cage matches Yokozuna had, so that might be a good statistic to look up to, you know, because that could be a rarity that we got to witness. For being my first WWF show, which ended up being a TV taping that ran for, what, 3.5 hours?
I think it was about 4 hours. I remember she was my girlfriend at the time, but my wife now, not a wrestling fan at all, but I dragged her because, you know, I didn't have any friends and really still don't, but took her to that, and she kept saying, when is this going to be? I didn't know at the time that it was a TV taping. I didn't really read the tickets, I guess, and it's like,
I don't think it until the week of, maybe.
Yeah, it got to the point where it's like, even I'm like, oh my God, let's end this.
Yeah, I mean, you took your girlfriend who ended up being your wife. I took my girlfriend who is now married to someone else. So at least you came out, I guess, on a positive side. So
that's true. Now, help me remember, were they recording Raws back then as well? Was that I feel like there was a Raw part of that as well, or was it all just for Superstars and Challenge?
Yeah, I think it was just Superstars and Challenge.
Okay.
And I know that was when the Undertaker fans, who may or may not have been Shane and Stephanie, depending on rumor, were in the crowd.
Because Undertaker wrestled Kama in a casket match, I believe.
Yes, he wrestled, and it was one of the few appearances of, I think it was Phantasmo.
Yes. I think that was his only WWF appearance. Man, that was I had forgotten all about that night. Thank you for bringing that up. A trip down memory lane, and my trip down memory lane continues with my number.
And by the way,
real quick,
I still have the ticket stub from that show. And granted, we were sitting up in the nosebleed sections, but I believe our tickets cost $12.50.
You know what? I'm going to look and see, because I saved a lot of my old ticket stubs. I'm going to see if I can find mine, because we were in the nosebleeds too. That would be so weird if we were that close, because we were also both at Hell in a Cell at Bad Blood, right?
Yeah. And I was also, were you at the show that had Warrior versus Vader and Shawn Michaels versus Goldust?
Yes. That was, I believe that was Father's Day.
Yes.
I took my dad that year. Yeah. It was 1996. Wow.
Yeah, it was 1 week before Austin 316.
Yeah, that's, oh man. Gosh, yeah, we'll have to share ticket stubs and see if we were sitting near each other.
I'll have to find it again, yeah.
That's
fun. But I remember that show was, Austin was the third match on the show facing Duke the Dumpster Drosy, and no one cared.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Funny how a week changes everything.
And a curtain call. my number four, again, I'm the nostalgia guy here with my picks, like deep nostalgia. June 2nd, 1987, the Honky Tonk Man pins Ricky the Dragon Steamboat for the Intercontinental title. It happened in Buffalo, New York. It was a part of Superstars of Wrestling. It was a taping that aired about 10 days later on June 13th. And this was a shock to me because, I was in high – that was the summer before high school for me. So, I obviously had smartened up to how the wrestling business worked, but so fresh still off of the WrestleMania 3 win, because back then we didn't have Monday Night Raw. We didn't have the weekly paper or the monthly pay-per-views. So I was really looking forward to a lengthy Intercontinental Championship run for Ricky Steamboat. And Honky Tonk Man at the time, and I really grew to become a big fan of his, to me was just another guy. He wasn't an SD Jones type or, I don't want to say jobber per se, but I didn't really think of him as someone that was going to become the Intercontinental Champion, and not only become the Intercontinental Champion, but hold it. Still to this day, for the longest period of time, 30 plus or 30, just over 30 years later, that record still stands. So, big upset, and rumor and innuendo suggests that it was because Steamboat wanted time off to spend time with family and whatnot. And I think Butch Reed was the actual original go-to guy, but Honky Tonk Man happened to be there. Butch Reed no-showed that taping or whatever. But then I saw a picture of Butch Reed in the locker room when they're celebrating the Honky Tonk Man's win, so I'm confused on that end of it. But anyway, the bottom line is Honky Tonk Man became a self-made man that night.
It's good to have friends in high places.
All righty. Number...
I'm just throwing out random bits of advice.
I agree. That is good. And speaking of, you know, in about an hour, the Powerball numbers, we're recording deep into the week, but Powerball is about to be drawn. So if I win and this show doesn't end up dropping, then you know why. No, I'm kidding.
But then no one would be listening to hear this. So
that's true. That was a pointless statement, like many of my statements.
If you're listening to the show, you know Kevin is still not the one to call for bail money.
Exactly. Who's your number three, or what's your number three?
My number three is going to be the day that we all thought the real, real American, Lex Luger, was about to take over the WWF and catapulted to championship stardom. That fateful day on the USS Intrepid in New York Harbor, where Jim Cornette, I believe it was Cornette, had set up the American Challenge to see who could slam the aforementioned, as we discussed earlier, Yokozuna, and football players that no one had ever heard of had come out of their woodwork to give it their shot. No one could do it. And then, miraculously, right before time ran out, a helicopter flew in, bringing in Lex Luger, and he was able to slam the evil Japanese champion, and well, that's about the highlight of what happened to Lex Luger in the summer of
1993.
Yeah. So that's my, just because it was such a, I'm thinking of, because it's such a random event, like, I think WWE should do more stuff like that, just randomly, you know, have something happen, but.
And fun fact, we saw the Intrepid in New York.
You did not let me body slam you. I'm so disappointed. Recreated.
We should have. We totally should have recreated that. That was pretty epic. And I was always a fan of the Narcissist. Although I never really saw him going much higher than he did. So maybe in hindsight, the transition to Lex Luger, the real American or the all-American, whatever they ended up going with. But, you know, according to Bruce Pritchard on Something to Wrestle With, Luger did not like the gimmick and did not like doing the whole Lex Express idea. He didn't want to do the meet and greets and tour the country, which, you know, the concept was great. I think the player, it was the wrong player. Luger didn't fit that mold.
No, he was no John Cena or Hulk Hogan.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's what they were looking for, was a Hogan replacement.
What's that?
They were looking for a Hulk Hogan replacement.
Yeah, but at that time in his life, I think Luger was more, you know, the anti-hero, not the big-kissing, high-five American hero that needed for that role.
They probably should have used Bret Hart, right? I'm kidding.
He is technically dual citizen, so they could have. And remember, the Rougeaus moved to America to show how much they loved America. So
that's true. I think Doink. They should have used Doink for that whole thing, but you know. My number three, yeah.
So paint him up red, white, and blue. It could have worked.
The Patriotic Clown. My number three will probably disappoint Chad to an extent, but it's SummerSlam 2013. This is the spoiler alert. This is the only current, and I say current 4 years ago, event that I have. Daniel Bryan beats John Cena for the WWE Championship in the main event. And then the kind of groundwork that was laid, and I know, you know, there's suggestions that that wasn't the original plan, what ended up happening, but it worked out perfectly, in my opinion. Bryan wins the championship, and it looked like, okay, he's finally legitimized because he had gone through the whole thing where he cashed in his Money in the Bank and beat the Big Show and Mark Henry, and then lost it in 18 seconds to Sheamus at WrestleMania at WrestleMania 28 in Miami. So you thought, okay, now he's beating John Cena, he's legit. And then that damn Randy Orton comes down and cashes in Money in the Bank. Triple H is the special guest referee, screws Bryan over, kicks him in the stomach. Pedigree, Orton's the new champion. And then the build and the fire and the chase started, where the odds were stacked against Daniel Bryan time after time after time, and he kept overcoming, overcoming, overcoming. And then, boom, he's in the main event at WrestleMania 30. My favorite WrestleMania that we've seen in person to date, and you know, overcame those odds, beating Triple H, Batista, and Randy Orton, not all at the same time, but beating, you know, basically Evolution, and you know, it was an incredible build up, but it all kind of, in my opinion, started right there at SummerSlam 2013.
I would agree. I believe I was at that show.
I was going to say, I knew it was at the Staples Center. I couldn't remember if you were there for that or not.
Yeah, I think I went to 12 and 13. My memory is so bad on what shows that I actually attend, or what year, especially when multiple shows are held at the same venue.
Yeah.
In second years. And they don't have numbers after them, so I can't. Or nice little symbols to identify them. But yeah, I was pretty sure that's when I was sitting fifth row right behind the announcers. So, if you look closely, there's a guy in a sheep mask that pops up occasionally. That was me. And that's also the guy in front of me had a sign that said, "Marry me, Bellas." Because, you know, the Bellas are on the hunt for, at the time, neither was married or engaged. But I believe they were dating their current boyfriends, and I'm sure they were just looking to find, you know, some random guy in the crowd to move on to. And, was that the same SummerSlam that had Punk versus Lesnar?
Yes, I believe it was.
And that's the one, yeah, because that was when that match came. I tapped the guy on the shoulder and was like, "Please keep your sign down during this match." And he got all offended and like, "Why can't I hold my sign?" I'm like, "Shut up! Your sign's stupid. Put it down and really rethink your life decisions."
Yeah, that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
Ignorant and asinine fans and their etiquette at events, especially pay-per-views where you've paid a lot of money to sit in the audience and then some douche is holding a sign up in front of your face the whole time.
I know. It's even worse when douches take signs that aren't even blank, that they're just blank blank poster board. I would never do that. Ever. I remember WrestleMania 22 and the girl in front of us had the sign that said, "Cena, I'm legal."
Yes. Yeah. What's your number two, man?
I was trying to think. I lost it. So I'm going to go. This is not a good pick. This is actually, as you were saying, you were a diehard WWF mark back in the day. I was more of a WCW fan. I was never a Hulkamaniac, with the exception of WrestleMania 1. That's because I hated Roddy Piper so much, because I was a stupid kid who didn't understand the art of good character work and good villains. I was like, "Oh, Roddy needs to be beaten up." So my number two is really, for me, the day WCW died. And that would be the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view, where Hulk Hogan made his WCW in-ring debut and beat Ric Flair for the title. I believe he beat Ric Flair for the title.
Yeah, he did.
Good. I'm glad I'm making stuff up and it's correct. Yeah, to me, that was the turning point of everything that was good in WCW just coming to a head and WCW turning into WWF Lite, which is still going on Thursday nights on Pop, and it's called GFW Impact.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that match up, because as much as, and in hindsight, you know, I never wanted Hogan to leave the WWF. You know, I by that point, Hulkamania had run its course for me. I was no longer a Hulkamaniac, but I didn't want to see him go to the quote unquote enemy, even though I still did watch both products. But yeah, I agree. You know, Hogan, you know, beating Flair for the championship. But, you know, listening to other podcasts, including the What Happened Win on Mondays with Tony Schiavone, he and Conrad have talked about it. And, you know, obviously bringing Hogan in was a very profitable move. And I think, you know, they kind of hit lightning in a bottle with Eric Bischoff being there and then being able to kind of open up Ted Turner's pocketbook and pay that big money to bring in Hogan and Savage and eventually some of the other guys that came in.
Beefcake, Jimmy Hart, the Renegade. The list goes on and on.
But that, you know, like you said, that yeah. didn't necessarily make it right. But the formula that they were using obviously needed something, and it gave him a shot in the arm for a bit. But I think at the end of the day, I mean, we can go on and debate what really killed WCW. But yeah, I don't disagree that. And I don't know if that match was really. I mean, gosh, that was a dream match. You know, what, 7-8 years prior, you know, 86, 87, could you imagine if those two would have hooked up in 86 or 87? They were both at the height of their popularity and probably their peak in-ring performances. And, you know, by 94, they'd already wrestled in WWF, which was kind of a failed experiment, at least by Vince McMahon's standards. So it was definitely a change that I didn't necessarily like, but one that really had a big impact on the business as well.
I agree. I mean, yes, from a business standpoint, I think bringing Hogan in was probably the best call they could have done because even though WCW had a talented roster, Hulk Hogan had eclipsed the business. And so bringing him in probably brought more eyes onto the product. It's just too bad that Bischoff was either a poor businessman or a money mark at the time for Hogan and allowed Hogan to have complete control over everything.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. And that's kind of been stated as well. So definitely you get what you pay for, so to speak.
Right.
My number two is from SummerSlam 1990. And, you know, I, as a kid growing up, I was a huge mark for Kerry Von Erich. And when my first wrestling memory, I mentioned 1983 was what hooked me, but my first wrestling memory was actually Ric Flair and Kerry Von Erich inside a steel cage in 1982, Christmas time. Michael Hayes slammed the cage door, or Terry Gordy slammed the cage door, and that set off the Von Erich Freebird feud. But anyway, from there, I became a huge Kerry Von Erich fan. When he signed with WWF in the summer of 1990, I was ecstatic because WWF, as I mentioned, was my company. Well, then he gets an Intercontinental Championship match because Brutus Beefcake kind of messed up his face and damn near died in a parasailing accident. So they needed a replacement. Von Erich was the replacement as the Texas Tornado, beat Mr. Perfect in just over 5 minutes. And became the IC champion. My only criticism of this was the run did not last very long. Perfect regained the championship and then later dropped it to Bret Hart a year later at SummerSlam, which was another epic match too. So, but yeah, big fan of Kerry Von Erich, was a fan of Mr. Perfect. So seeing those two go at it is my number two.
Yeah, I know you have discussed your appreciation of Kerry many times. Again, I watched WCCW, but out of all the major promotions, I think that was probably just above AWA on my radar. And so I was more familiar with Mid-South than I was World Class.
Mm.
So seeing Kerry in WWF, I mean, it was shocking that he went there at the time, but I don't really have that a lot of memories of Kerry pre-WWF.
See, now, did you ever, because you came to the WWF shows in St. Louis, did you ever come to any of the old NWA shows?
No, like I said, that WWF show in 94 was the first show that I'd ever been to, other than a couple of, I want to say, Central States shows that were held in the local high school gym.
Yeah.
Which is where Ric Flair versus Harley Race, which is cool. But, I mean, those were the only ones, the only other people that I remember on those shows were the Barton twins and somebody, Ferris. His finishing move was an airplane spin called the Ferris Wheel.
Was it Earthquake Ferris?
Probably.
Okay. Yeah, I remember Central States pretty well, but I think for me, World Class was just it was the first product that I saw, and it was on Saturday nights and Sunday mornings in the St. Louis market. So you had two chances to watch it. What's that?
What channel was it on?
I believe World Class was on Channel 30, KDNL.
30? Okay.
I think.
Yeah, we had 30, but I don't remember seeing World Class on there. And then, and like I said, in summer of 84, my family got one of the large satellites, which is how I started watching World Class and AWA. And that's how I actually found WWF before they got on to the Wrestling at the Chase slot.
Mm, yeah. And part of that, you know, World Class, they would send guys to St. Louis. Like the first NWA show I went to might have been the second. But anyway, Flair main evented both of them. But Bruiser Brody, who had been a frequent guest in World Class, and Kerry Von Erich were Flair's respective opponents. You know, Kevin Von Erich would come up and wrestle as well. So I just getting to see them in person and then on TV as well just kind of locked me into that. And again, it's more of the nostalgia thing than anything, because I know people are probably listening to my list and thinking, good Lord, these are some really random and weird choices. And some of yours are too, but I think that's kind of what makes it good. And I'm glad that we haven't picked any of the same yet. So with that being
said, number one, it will not be the same.
So. Awesome. Well, what's your number one? Do you know what my number one is?
I'm trying to think of when you met Neville.
that was in January. So no, it's not. It's not Neville.
my number one is a full event. It's probably the best show that I've ever attended. Top to bottom, there wasn't one card that was a bathroom break moment. The crowd was really hot for it. It was really hot outside. And that is ECW's Heatwave 98. So you started off with Just Incredible versus Jerry Lynn. You had the return of Tammy Lynn Sitch to ECW. Kind of through all the matches. Taz and Bam and Bigelow, where they went through the rampway.
Now, you were there for this one, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, this is the best show I've ever seen. Yeah.
Okay.
And the main event was Sandman, Tommy Dreamer, and Spike Dudley versus the Dudley Boys. And prior to the event, when we were outside, because you know how I am, I like to get to venues early and stand outside for some reason. We were standing outside, and New Jack came out and was cutting a promo in the crowd. And then all of a sudden, the Dudley Boys come speeding into the parking lot and get out and just start beating the hell out of New Jack. And if you watch, when we were watching the show back later, like the crowd kind of like makes a circle around the beating because, you know, why would you not just gather around and watch or mug somebody? And my cousin is just in the background, like, mugging out himself, like, trying to, like, over-exaggerating his reactions to it, which to us was amusing. To people at home, they would have no clue. Yeah, and it was just, like I said, the only bad part was we had, I think we were 15th or 16th row on the floor for the start of the show. And when you go to a show, if you are more than 5 or 6 rows back, it is best to be up in the, you know, in the side seats and the bleachers or whatever you want to call them, because with everybody standing, you just can't see anything, especially when they go outside of the ring and fight around ringside. And so after the third match, we moved up into the general admission seating and just had a great time. This woman that was sitting next to us when Sandman came out, Like, she ran down and was taking photos and then came back with his beer can. He had thrown it into the crowd, and she caught it. And she's like, look, I got this. I'm like, that's awesome. Before the show, some kid was wearing a Bret Hart shirt, and the crowd just got on his case, and somehow he took the shirt off and gave it to someone, and they ripped it up, and then they passed around a hat to take up a collection so that he could go buy an ECW t-shirt. But yeah, overall, this is just, like I said, top to bottom, best show that I've been to, best experience, and now if I was in that same environment, I'd probably complain and say it was the worst show and crowds are annoying because I'm old and cynical.
Yeah, I was going to say, 19 years later, I don't think you would have the same reaction to that show.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, ECW, I was a huge fan during, you know, from like 96 through 2001, but looking back, I don't think a lot of ECW holds up. And I don't think ECW could, even if, had they not folded in 2001, I don't think ECW in 2017 would be anything resembling what it was at that time. Hopefully, you know, Raven wouldn't still be being all moody and depressed, trying to be champion. But at that time, it was the perfect, I think it perfectly captured the movement of the late 90s.
It's a good pick. I thought you had been to that show, and I wondered if it would make your list. So when you hadn't said it early on, I was wondering. But yeah, good choice. I have not seen that one. I'll have to go back. I'm assuming it's on the network. I can go back and look at that.
Channel 99.
Awesome. Well, my number one, and I'll give you a quick backstory on it. Summer of 1991, I had graduated high school and was on vacation in Florida with my family and happened to be watching WCW Saturday Night, and they ran a crawl that said, due to a contract dispute, Ric Flair was being stripped of the WCW Heavyweight Championship, and the upcoming pay-per-view where he was going to be defending against Lex Luger was now going to be Lex Luger versus Barry Windham inside a cage, and the winner of that would win the championship. And I thought it was all kind of a ploy. I thought maybe Flair was hurt. Again, this was before the internet, so you couldn't go online and find out what was happening, and I didn't subscribe to the dirt sheets. Well, fast forward about a month, and Wrestling Challenge comes to an end, and Bobby Heenan, Gorilla Monsoon, and Jim Neidhart are standing there talking, and Bobby Heenan is holding the big gold belt. And I remember thinking, what in the hell? Because Flair, as we've talked about before, all-time favorite for me, and I think he is yours as well. And, you know, seeing that and then the description that Bobby goes into and then saying Ric Flair's name on the air was just, you know, I'm 18 years old, but I was marking out like crazy. And I've even used that soundbite, part of that soundbite, in the open for the My 123 Cents podcast. That's, excuse me, 26 years later, it's still that strong to me. So, yeah, that is my favorite moment because from the summertime, because, as I said, Flair's my all-time favorite, and he was coming to my favorite company. It just was the perfect storm there with bringing him in to the WWF. Now, what happened after that can be debated, but those moments leading up to it and that anticipation without even seeing him, but just that belt and the symbolism, to me, rivals Scott Hall showing up on Nitro, you know, back in 96, in part because, like I said, there were no spoilers back then. It was a legitimate surprise that Flair was coming to the WWF.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that moment when it happened. Yeah, my cousin, I wasn't watching at the time, and my cousin called me. It's like, you got to come see this. Like, and we lived two blocks apart, so I ran over to his house and just caught the tail end of that. But yeah, Flair showing up in WWF was something you did not think would ever happen.
Yeah.
And he had a good couple years there, and 92 Royal Rumble kind of stands out as a highlight.
Absolutely, and probably down the road, because we're going to do our sixth sense probably maybe once a month or when it is necessary, if you will. But Royal Rumbles, you know, when big events are coming around, that we kicked it off with summer events because of SummerSlam, obviously. But we'll come up with some other topics. And if you guys have ideas or suggestions, let us know on the My 1-2-3 Cents Facebook or Twitter pages. And also be sure to let us know your favorite moments from the summertime. Chad, any last final words before we wrap up? What do you got coming up on Positive Cynicism?
The next week's episode, which will drop the day after this one, but if you, it's a podcast. I don't know why we say drop and everything. It'll be available. You can check it out in the archives if you are listening to this months down the road. We're going to have a State of the Union podcast coming up as the next episode. We're kind of going to go under some revamping, some construction work, because, you know, politics is, when I started the show, I thought politics would be a heavy part of it, but when ESPN is pulling Asian reporters off of football games because their name may trigger the audience, I'm kind of over politics, and I just can't, I can't do it anymore. So, coming up, I believe in 2 weeks or so, in two episodes, stealing another idea from another podcast that I recently listened to, and I'm going to have a guest on, and we're going to break down the music of 1991 and how 91 kind of changed the musical landscape.
Oh, I can't wait to hear that. That was a big year for me. So, yeah, I look forward to listening to that one.
Yeah, New Kids on the Block were on their way out. I was depressed.
But we had Vanilla Ice and MC Hammer.
You know, MC Hammer is actually doing a concert out here at Staples Center in a couple months.
Are you going to go?
What's that?
Are you going to go?
No, I've actually seen MC Hammer for free. And ticket prices are like $60 or $100.
Wow.
I'm like, I checked my calendar just to make sure that I was still in 2017, even though, given all the bands that I have seen this year, were playing 30 years ago. I don't know who's paying $100 to see MC Hammer right now. But anyway, I digress. Yes, awesome. 91 was a pivotal year for music.
Well, be sure to check that out. It is Positive Cynicism. There is a Facebook page for it as well, or at Chad Smart on Twitter. Chad, any other final thoughts before we say goodbye?
No, not really. I think we covered everything, and I made it through all six picks, and I don't think the audience realized that my 4 through 6 were made up on the spot. So.
Well, they were good picks, and this was fun.
Yeah, I will say, you know, give a shout out to Tom and Jim for inspiring this. And Tom, I don't know if you've listened to it, but Tom also has a podcast with his brother called Skullbuster Wrestling, I think it is. It's called Buster. It's on Podbean. It's an interesting, you know, discussion of wrestling every 2 weeks. So if you don't get enough of Kevin talking wrestling on a weekly basis, you can check that one out as well. We'll give him a little plug. Hopefully they'll return the favor. If not, I kind of know where they live.
So. Yeah, I have not checked out that one, but I am going to add it to my list because there are many that I listen to now. So, well, everyone, again, check out to the Jittery Monkey Podcasting Network, also on Facebook and Twitter. You can check out Greg Mahochko's shows, Nerd United, as well as the Five Heart podcast, which is all about Nebraska Cornhusker athletics. And with football season ramping up, he'll be dropping some new episodes as well. And again, thanks for the support of My 1-2-3 Cents, Positive Cynicism, and all the other fun little things that we do around here. So have a great week, everyone, and we'll check you back in with you next week.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.